This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had to be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Well, this is Gary Clinton, and I'd like to welcome you to episode number 69 of Night Transmissions. First up is an episode of The Crime Club, which originally aired on March the 27th of 1947, called Silent Witnesses, adapted from a book by John Stephen Strange. The Crime Club is a series that ran on Mutual in 1946 and 1947, most of which were taken from a series of Doubleday books that ran under the imprint of The Crime Club, publishing a new mystery book every week from 1921 until the 1980s. If you're much of an aficionado of old-time radio, you are going to recognize the voice of the librarian who opens and closes the show. He was a major presence in old-time radio, best known really for his work on The Inner Sanctum, where he played the host, Raymond. In real life, he was Raymond Johnson. The night's episode, from March 27th of 1947, opens with a young woman who is drowsily reading a mystery book and drifts off to sleep. Then she wakes abruptly and frightened to the sound of gunfire, convinced that it comes from the flat just directly below her. After a while, she does build up her courage and goes down to investigate and becomes convinced that it had only been a dream. Only a dream. Right? Of course not.
Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Yes, this is the Crime Club. I'm the librarian. Silent Witnesses. Yes, we have that Crime Club book for you. Come right over. Take the easy chair by the window. Comfortable? The book is on the shelf. Here it is, Silent Witnesses, by John Stephen Strange. The very unusual story of a letter that was registered by death. Let's look at it under the reading lamp. It was early evening, and the blizzard that had been going all day gave no sign of blowing itself out. Mary Masterman didn't care. She was home in her upstairs apartment in the quaint two-story building in Greenwich Village. And she was comfortable. Too comfortable, as a matter of fact. Because in the midst of the mystery novel she was reading, the book dissolved on her lap. She dissolved on the sofa. And before long, she was sound asleep.
Blowing the bugle again. Hi, Francis.
I've got to see you, Barney.
What's the matter, honey?
I don't know, but I'm afraid something terrible has happened.
What?
I don't know how to explain, but I think there's been a murder.
You think?
Yes. Please hurry.
Where's the corpse, Mary?
Corpse, dear?
You said something about a murder, didn't you?
Yes.
Well, where is it?
Barney, are you going to be mad at me?
Now, look, precious, I'm not going to be.
You're so sweet.
I am hopping mad. Look, what's the idea of making me drive for an hour in that blizzard all the way from the Bronx?
I had to, Barney. I was frightened.
By whom? The mysterious traveler?
I thought I heard two shots.
Huh? What's that?
Two pistol shots. They seemed to come from just below.
Frank Warren's apartment?
Mm-hmm. But I didn't really hear them.
What?
I was dreaming. I was reading a mystery book, and I fell asleep. And then...
Bing, bang. But it was all a dream.
It must have been.
Aren't you sure?
Oh, yes. After I phoned you, I decided not to be a scary Mary, so I went down to Frank Warren's apartment.
And there he was. Oh, how'd you do? And how are you?
Oh, don't be silly. I didn't go in.
Well, of course not. Why visit a live lawyer?
I didn't even see him.
Huh?
I listened at his door, and I was satisfied. He was moving around the apartment.
How do you know?
What?
How do you know it was Frank Vaughn who was moving around?
Oh, now look, Barney.
Maybe it was a murderer. Oh, Mary, you're lucky.
What do you mean?
Suppose he opened the door and seen you. What then?
Are you trying to frighten me all over again?
You scared me, didn't you? I thought you stepped in on an author or something.
You idiot.
No, you idiot.
Do you still love me?
Well, as long as I'm here. Oh, baby.
Darling.
No sugar shortage here. All right. We've flirted long enough. Now.
What?
Fix me a drink. Then we'll go downstairs and tell Frank Vaughn about your dream. It ought to kill him for sure.
Must have gone out, Barney.
Yeah. He's even crazier than I am.
What are you doing?
See?
Barney.
Am I surprised? Does he always keep his door unlocked?
Well, how would I know?
I didn't say you should, Mary.
Then why did you ask? Just because Frank and I are the only tenants in this house doesn't mean...
Look out for that table.
I see it. Imagine Frank keeping that window open as though it was summer.
I better close it.
No, let's go back upstairs.
Wait a minute.
We've got no right to be here. Frank isn't home, and besides, I'm cold.
Mary, you said you heard two shots.
Oh, not that again. I told you I was dreaming.
You weren't.
What?
That's right, honey. Look at that wall.
A hole.
The kind a bullet makes. With my penknife.
What are you going to do?
Dig, baby.
But you can't.
Who says so?
Now listen, Vaughn. Oh.
What's the matter?
Over here by the fireplace.
Blood?
A broken cocktail glass.
Uh-huh. Well, here it is, Precious.
A bullet?
From a 25.
Well, then I wasn't dreaming. Oh, Barney, what happened here tonight?
I don't know, but I want you to do a little thinking.
All right.
Were there two shots or only one?
I can't be sure.
You've got to be.
Well, it seemed like two, but...
Yeah?
But I was fast asleep, Barney, and if there were two, where's the other bullet? And where's... Oh!
Get off the edge, Mary. It's only the third. Yes?
Mr. Vaughn?
Uh-huh.
This is Mr. Masson, Thomas Masson.
Yes?
I expected to hear from you today about that offer I made.
Oh, did you?
Now, see here, Mr. Vaughn, I think I've been very generous. You know my stepsister Hilda hasn't got a case against me. She can't possibly break Aunt Helen's last will and testament. It's bona fide.
Then why bother to make offers?
As I told you the other day, I don't want the unpleasantness of a trial in court. I'm not going to give Hilda the satisfaction of a cash settlement out of court. I'd rather do business with you, privately.
Yes.
Now think it over. And you don't earn $100,000 every day. Goodbye.
Ouch. Do you hear that, Mary?
I don't believe it, Barney.
You mean the $100,000?
I don't believe Frank Vaughn would sell out a client.
He hasn't done it yet, Precious.
He wouldn't even think of it.
Such neighborly faith.
Oh, Barney.
All right. Let's go.
By all means.
We're going uptown to Ted Lasseter's nightclub.
Well, what's there?
Hilda. And when she opens her mouth, some call what comes out singing. I call it, after you, sweetheart. You see? see Hilda around?
No, but I see Ted Lasseter.
Hmm? Where?
That corner table.
Oh, yeah. Over in March. Doesn't look very gay, does he?
Maybe you know what's wrong with him.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Keep your eyebrows on. I'll show you.
Ooh, tingling with excitement.
Shh. I want to surprise him. You want to roll for the club, Ted?
Huh? Who said that?
Hiya, pal.
Well, what's the idea, Ronnie?
Just trying you out, that's all.
Well, don't do that again. You newspaper guys. Anything for a laugh, huh?
Anything.
What's he got on you, Ted?
Nothing. Who's been telling you things, Bonnie?
Rumor hath it, chum, and when rumor hath it in this town, it's practically Winslow.
Yeah. You're a nice kid, Bonnie.
Thanks.
So don't believe everything you hear.
I'll make a note of that.
And don't talk about what you don't believe.
Sure.
Would one of you mind telling me?
Well, you heard what he just said, Mary. It's a lie.
What's a lie?
The blizzard we left outside. Where's Hilda, Ted?
She's in my office.
Mind if I go in there?
Yeah, she's on the phone.
Oh, that's all right. I won't listen.
That's what I said, Bonnie. She's talking to her lawyer.
Frank Vaughn?
What kind of drinks you want, kids? On the house.
But, Bonnie, if she's talking to Frank...
A scotch and soda, Ted.
I'll get a waiter. How about you, Mary?
Oh, I feel wonderful. How are you?
Well, Bonnie, is she okay?
Perfect.
Then, what is she...
You don't understand, Ted. We had a terrible scare about Frank. You see, I was home alone, and around 7 o'clock, I thought I heard two shots in Frank's apartment.
You, what?
But it wasn't two shots. It was only one shot. Because after Barney came over, we went downstairs and investigated.
Where was Frank?
What? Oh, Hilda.
Was he there?
No, but what's the difference? He's home now.
Is he?
You just spoke to him, didn't you?
No, Mary.
Well, I... But Hilda, baby, you were in my office half an hour.
There was no answer. You know what it means, Ted.
Maybe.
Those two shots Mary heard.
Only one.
He had that letter Aunt Helen sent me just before she died. He took it home with him tonight. He was going to have a handwriting expert check it.
Maybe he didn't take it after all.
I told you I saw him put it into his briefcase. I was with him in his office up to 5:30, and I left the building with him.
Okay, so the handwriting expert checked it, and Frank went out someplace. Now, what's there to worry about?
He didn't phone me, and he said he would. Tom would do anything to get that letter. He'd kidnap or murder.
What was in it, Hilda?
$3 million worth of evidence, Barney. My whole case against Tom.
How about some particulars?
Sure, why not? About a week before Aunt Helen died, that slimy stepbrother of mine got her to sign a paper.
A will?
Yes. She was having one of her bad days, and she didn't know what she was doing. But a couple of days later, she remembered something. The butler and the cook had been present when Tom gave her that paper to sign.
Witnesses?
That's right. And she couldn't understand why. Tom wouldn't tell her, and the servants didn't know. But she was worried. So she wrote that letter telling what happened and got the doctor to mail it to me.
Well, why didn't she give it to you?
I was in Europe. I didn't even know she was dying. By the time I got back to New York,
come on, now, take it easy, baby.
The will was filed, and all I got was $1. $1! And Tom walked off with the millions. And now he's going to keep them. He's got that letter.
You don't know Hilda.
He's got it, Ted. Not... So long, kiddies.
Where are you going?
Guess.
Your stepbrother?
Of course. It's the logical move.
I'm going with you.
Thanks, Ted, but I can frighten him all by myself.
But just a minute, Hilda.
What is it, Barney?
Your aunt owned a mansion on West 84th Street, didn't she?
Yes. She died there.
Anybody using it now?
Nobody. It's boarded up. Why?
No reason. I was just thinking about the housing shortage. Let's go, Mary. And give my best to your stepbrother, Hilda. And don't shoot without counting the steps to the death house.
You're absolutely crazy, Barney.
Mary, you say the nicest things.
You'd have to be to believe that Frank's hiding out in that house.
I didn't say I believe it, did I?
Then why are we going there?
To do a routine check. Look, Precious, there's something rotten in this state of Masson versus Masson, and it might be Frank Vaughn.
You're crazy.
Well, okay by me, but where's Frank?
I don't know. He might be dead.
He might be. Who killed him?
Tom Masson.
Just like that, huh?
Well, he had to get that letter, Barney, or lose $3 million.
There was only one shot, Precious, and we found the bullet in the wall.
I'm not so sure about that now.
Huh?
The more I think of it, the more I... Of course, I was asleep. But, darling, even so, would I hear two shots if there'd only been one?
Well, I...
And that broken cocktail glass and the missing bullet, what do they mean? Those silent witnesses that something dreadful might have happened. Oh, Barney, I don't feel good about it.
That's why we got to keep looking for Frank Vaughn.
All right, but why in that house?
Because it's boarded up and out of circulation. If Tom Masson killed Frank, it'd be an ideal place to park the body. But if he didn't...
Yes. He'd want people to think that Frank had disappeared.
But if he didn't, Mary?
Step on the gas, Barney. We've got to hurry.
I hope you're not disappointed.
What was that?
Hallelujah. And on a night like this. Reach into that glove compartment, Mary, and hand me my flashlight, please.
A blowout?
In more ways than one.
Oh.
Well.
By the way, Barney.
Yes, my adorable one.
Why didn't you tell Hilda about that phone call Tom made?
Is that all you've got to offer, Precious?
I just happened to think of it.
Well, if it'll keep you comfortable, darling, it was because she already had murder in her heart, and I didn't want to put it in her hands. Come on, honey.
Here's something we didn't think of, Barney. How do we get into a house that's boarded up?
That's easy. Show me a keyhole, and I'll show you a way to get in. And there it is, the front door. No boards.
I still don't see how you're going to do it.
Live and learn, honey. And there's so much to do about. Watch now. I take this pass key, pass it into the keyhole, give a turn like this, and presto!
Oh, full of tricks, aren't you? You can get into a lot of trouble doing such things.
Not such things, honey. Come on, let's get out of the store. Oh, hand me my flashlight. Thanks.
Nice and warm in here.
Yeah. Almost as though it were being lived in.
That does smell like coal heat, doesn't it?
Uh-huh. Let's look around. That room over there first. That should be the living room.
I'm beginning not to like this very much, Barney.
Oh, you'll get over it just as soon as we... Yeah, it is the living room. Mm-hmm. So this is how the 10% live.
When they're living.
Okay. Let's try the rest of the house.
Barney, Barney!
Hey!
I've been locked in!
Cut us out! We know you're here, Frank Vaughn. You'll never get away with this, you know.
Don't wear yourself out, Barney.
Yeah, but we're trapped. We... Well, don't you care?
You still have the pass key.
Huh? Oh, sure. I was just about to think of it myself. Precious little pass key.
Well, Barney, open it.
I can't.
But don't be silly. You opened the outside door.
Yes, honey, but it's not working on this one.
Well, now what do we do? The window's boarded up and that door... Couldn't you break it down?
That hunk of timber? Well, I'm good, Precious, but not that good. Yeah, Frank Vaughn's a nice guy. He wouldn't sell out a client. Not much.
That could have been Tom Masson out there, Barney.
Sure, he was just waiting for us to get here.
Barney.
What is this between you and Frank Vaughn?
Barney, don't you smell something?
You bet I do. I smell a rat, and I...
Nothing like coal gas?
Yeah.
Well, where's it coming from?
I'll let you know in a minute. That hot air vent...
Somebody's trying to kill us.
You're not kidding. And whoever's fooling around with that furnace isn't kidding either.
Good night, Joseph.
Good night, Mr. Masson, sir.
Well, turn a corner and look what you meet.
Hilda.
Hello, Tom.
What are you doing here?
Cute, aren't you? Let's go to your apartment.
I have nothing to say to you.
Really?
Now, look here, Hilda.
After you, Tom.
All right. But if you think you're going to bully me the way
you've... Step along, little man, or this gun will have something to say to you. I'm still after you.
Very well.
You're so rich now, you can afford to go out and leave the lights on.
Not your money, Hilda.
Where's the letter?
Letter?
The one Aunt Helen wrote me. I sent you a photostatic copy. So don't pretend to look as innocent as you look.
Oh. Do you want that copy now?
I want the original.
No.
Frank Vaughn had it and you took it.
This is too good to be true. So you've lost your case.
The letter, Tom.
I haven't got it.
Don't lie to me. Somehow you found out that Frank was going to take it home and have it checked.
Did I?
You murdered him and stole that letter.
Really, you're slightly out of your mind.
I'm going to kill you, Tom.
Now, look here, Hilda. Frank Vaughn was your lawyer. I had nothing to do with him except through my lawyer. I never even spoke to the man.
I want that letter, Tom.
You don't believe me. Well, how can I convince you?
Don't even try.
You'd be a fool to shoot me, Hilda. Everyone knows how much you hate me.
Nobody knows how much I really hate you.
Even if you manage to get out of this building. You'll be arrested sooner or later. Neither of us will have the money. Hilda, listen to me.
What for?
I'll make a deal with you. Give you $100,000.
Of my money?
Aunt Helen left it to me. It's in her will.
Who do you think you're kidding?
I don't care about that letter. You can't prove that Aunt Helen wrote it.
No? Is that why you killed Frank Vaughn?
I didn't. Didn't even know he was dead.
Oh, a snake can take lessons from you.
I'll give you $250,000.
All I want's the letter.
But I told you...
And I told you I don't believe it. Well?
All right.
Where is it?
I'll get it for you. Let's have a drink first.
What for?
To celebrate your victory. Won't take a minute. What would you like?
Nothing. From you.
Oh, come now, Hilda. How about some brandy and soda? Now, you give me that gun.
I'll give it to you.
It was very foolish, Hilda. What will the neighbors think?
Oh, my wrist.
That's better. Now, Hilda, you wanted to know about a letter. I haven't got it. And I'm awfully sorry I had to ruin that beautifully made-up face of yours.
Just another minute, Mary. Before it's off the window.
Well, hurry, Barney. Get coal gas.
There's some air coming in the window. It's a good thing you thought of that. Fireplace, great. What a weapon. We're through. Come on, now, let's get out of here.
Oh, you don't have to ask me twice. Oh, did you ever see such a lovely blizzard?
Up to it, kid. We got a lot of work to do.
Oh, no. No, don't tell me we're going back into that house the front way.
Not this team. There won't be anybody here to go back for.
What do you mean?
Whoever tried to kill us is far, far away by now.
You didn't say it was Frank Vaughn, Barney.
No? I must be slipping.
You wouldn't be changing your mind about him, would you?
Oh, look, honey, right now I'm too tired to change anything.
What's the matter?
Let's get back to Frank's apartment and see if he's taken anything for a change.
His toothbrush is here.
Yeah, and the shaving things. Mary, there's something funny here.
Is there?
Yeah, the brush is still damp.
So?
And the razor. There's soap on it. Hand me that towel, will you, please?
All right, but what's the rumpus about?
It's dry. It's a fresh towel, too.
Barney, would you mind telling me...
I was just wondering, Mary. Frank was a pretty neat guy.
Was?
He wouldn't leave dirty stuff lying around. None of it wasn't his habit.
Barney, if you're saying that Frank was murdered...
I'm only thinking, Precious. Let's go into the living room. Frank was expecting somebody tonight, or why bother shaving?
Well, Hilda told us, the handwriting expert.
Uh-huh. But would I shave for a handwriting expert? No. I would shave if I were expecting a beautiful woman.
Hilda?
Why not? How do we know that she was really trying to get Frank Vaughn on the phone?
We don't.
Might have been an act to impress Ted Lasseter, just in case she might need an alibi.
I don't get it. Why should she kill her own lawyer?
I didn't say she did, Mary, but suppose she found out that there was going to be a deal. That she was going to lose that letter.
I don't believe it. I don't believe Frank Vaughn
would... Yeah, I know. He wouldn't sell out a client. But there's a possibility that he was going to. And Hilda came here and killed him out of sheer venom and took back her letter.
And then what did she do with his body? Make a hocus-pocus until it evaporated?
Yeah, well, that's what I don't understand. Is Frank Vaughn alive and somewhere, or is he dead and... Mary.
I'm listening.
A little while ago, you said something about silent witnesses.
Yes. The broken cocktail glass and the bullet in the wall and the missing second bullet.
How about that open window?
Well, what about it?
This is a ground floor apartment and that window faces the backyard. It's possible, Mary. It's just possible.
But what are you doing?
Climbing out. Turn on all the lamps, will you, honey? I want plenty of light.
But Barney!
Mary, the lamp.
All right, but I know you're crazy. I just know it. I'll never believe what you're thinking. We couldn't have been running all over town while he was... Barney!
Stay away from the window, Mary. Yeah. Buried in the snow. In his own backyard.
But, Barney, of all the places to leave it...
Maybe that...
In snow.
Well, maybe that's all the killer needed.
But in a couple of weeks...
Somebody had to make it look as though Frank had disappeared. Somebody who had a lot to do in a little time.
Hello?
Oh, hello, Mr. Thomas Mason.
Yeah?
This is Frank Vaughn.
What?
I decided to make that deal with you. Come down to my apartment and bring that...
But, Mr. Vaughn, I...
You still want that letter, don't you?
Well, certainly, but I...
All right, then. Bring the money. $100,000. That was the price, wasn't it?
Well,
have you changed your mind?
I don't know what to say. But if you wish to talk to me, I'll pay you a visit. I'll be there in an hour.
Thank you. Goodbye. That's that. You're a pretty cagey guy. He knows something.
Is he coming?
So he said. We'll see. If he doesn't show up, then we'll know he knows we know. Or somebody knows. Now for suspect number two. And such a cute little suspect.
Hello. Ted Lasseter talking.
Good evening, Mr. Lasseter. May I speak with Hilda Mason, please?
Okay. Who's calling?
Her attorney, Frank Vaughn.
Who?
Frank Vaughn. I promised to call Miss Mason about a certain report, but I was detained. Will you put her on, please?
Well, certainly, but she's doing a song number now. You want me to give her a message?
If you don't mind. Tell her to come to my apartment. It's very important.
I'll do that.
Thank you. Goodbye.
How lovely. Now all we've got to do is wait. And worry.
You stay here in the kitchen, Mary.
But why, Barney? You said the killer wouldn't come.
I've been fooled before, and I don't want to. Will you do as I say, please? I can't keep our visitor waiting.
All right, but you're cheating.
Be right with you. Sorry to have kept you.
Hello, Barney.
Ted.
You thought you fooled me, didn't you? You ought to take lessons in voice disguise.
Ted Lasseter.
Back away from that door, pal.
Sure, but you don't have to point that gun right at me. I can have just as much respect for it if it were looking somewhere else.
Yeah? Where's the girl?
Mary? She's upstairs in her apartment.
You don't say.
She was very tired, and tomorrow is just another working day, you know.
You don't mind if I look around, do you?
How can I mind? But she would be in that kitchen. She's got a kitchen of her own upstairs. And it's very, very cute.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to go up there and see it sometime. Okay, I'll search the rest of the apartment when I get through with you. Well, sit down, Barney.
Do I have to?
Well, I want you to be comfortable. You're a pal. You tip me off to things before the cops find out.
How do you know the cops didn't find out?
Where are they, Barney?
Oh, well,
they'd be all over the place if they knew, and they aren't. They're not even hiding.
All right, Ted. You're going to kill me.
You were a nice guy, Barney.
Wait. Every dying man is allowed one last request. Will you tell me...
Why did I kill Frank Vaughn?
No, I just figured that out for myself.
Yeah? Well, that's good.
You dropped $50,000 in a dice game. The boys gave you 30 days to pay up, but they wanted collateral.
You got a nose for news, Barney. It's too bad it's going to be cold.
So you put up your nightclub. And then tonight, Hilda told you that Frank had taken that letter home to have it checked.
You're not wrong.
And that letter was worth a lot of blackmail money.
So I took it. Is that all, pal?
One last request. Did you collect on it?
Not yet.
Who are you going to talk to about it, Hilda or Tom Masson?
Tom. He's got the dough. Why bother with outsiders?
Then Hilda and Tom didn't know that you got it.
No, but Tom's going to find out tomorrow.
Oh, well. By the way, Ted, how'd you get that key to that house on 84th Street?
I borrowed it from Hilda's dressing room. Well, any more questions?
Yeah, just one more. Nice work, Mary. You knocked him cold.
Don't catch me, Barney. I'm going to faint.
Oh, hey, you can't do that, honey.
I never hit a man with a bottle full of soda before.
Well, you couldn't expect a better time, Precious. Oh, you wonderful microbe. Where were you when Ted looked in the kitchen?
I was under the table.
What?
And Barney, that's where I want to be from now on.
And so closes tonight's Crime Club book, Silent Witnesses, based on a story by John Stephen Strange. Stedman Coles did the radio adaptation. Roger Bauer produced and directed. Chet Stratton played Barney Gant. Sherita Bauer was Mary Masterman. Arthur Vinton was Ted Lasseter. Julie Stevens was Hilda Masson. And Ted Osborne played Tom Masson. Oh, I beg your pardon. Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Yes, this is a crime club. I'm the librarian.
program came from New York. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Yeah, okay. This is the first break for today. I know. You don't need them. But I need them. I guess. Speaking of Raymond Johnson, here he is again as Raymond, the host of the Inner Sanctum, in a story from October the 23rd of 1945, called The Corridor of Doom. It's about a man, a very sick man, in a hospital who finds himself walking down an endless hallway. I heard that. Somebody muttered, "So what?" Well, so what if I told you that the man is played by Karloff, Boris Karloff? I thought so. That's different, isn't it?
Inner Sanctum Mysteries, starring Boris Karloff. Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is your host. Welcome again through the squeaking door to another session of mystery, murder, and madness. Oh, excuse me if I don't get up, but I'm all worn out. Yes, I've had a hectic few days with an old friend who just blew into town. He's one of those earnest souls who insists on doing everything for himself. Consultations with the monument makers, the grave diggers, fittings of the coffin makers. Yes, quite a busy body. But then we only die once, you know. Our story is called The Corridor of Doom. It's an original radio play written by Robert Newman. And our star tonight is a man who gives even me the shakes. The famous star of stage, screen, and radio, Boris Karloff. Have you thought about death lately? Not the fact that it's inevitable, that it must come to all of us someday, but rather how it will come. Do you think of it as a sleep and a waking? Of a sudden transition from one state of being to another, or to a state of non-being. John Clay was one of those people who never thought about it at all, until he found himself walking down that dim and endless passage which... But suppose we let Boris Karloff in the role of John Clay tell you about it himself. If your blood pressure will take it, put out the light. And come on a little trip down the Corridor of Doom. When I woke up, I had no idea of where I was or how I'd gotten there. I was lying on a hard white bed in a clean white room. There was a dull pain in my abdomen. Touching it tentatively, I felt a bandage. So that was it. An operation. But for what? And where was I? At that moment, the door opened. And she came in. Good afternoon. Or is it evening?
Whichever you prefer. It doesn't matter.
My name's Clay. John Clay.
Yes.
And yours?
You can call me Nada.
Exactly. Where am I? In what hospital?
It has no name.
What? Well, that's ridiculous. I'd like to speak to Dr. Rogers. If you'll get him for me, please.
There is no Dr. Rogers. At least, not here.
Then who operated on me? And for what? Listen, I'm not a well man. I've a very bad heart. Will you get someone who can talk to me?
If you wish. I'll call Dr. Stone.
A chill crept through my bones. It wasn't cold. It was fear. Unreasoning and abysmal fear. The door opened again, and there stood a heavy-set man, his hair flecked with gray, and with him, my son-in-law, Alex Bartlett. Alec, I can't tell you how glad I am to see you.
Hello, Father.
But why are you standing out there? Why didn't you come in?
Oh, no. No, I
shouldn't advise it, Mr. Clay. And why not? And why... Oh, is it you who operated on me?
Yes. I'm Dr. Stone.
Why wasn't Dr. Rogers called in? He's taken care of me for years.
There wasn't time. It happened during the night. Acute appendicitis. And even as it was...
Even as it was? What? And why are you dressed that way, Alec? All in black.
Well, it's customary. After all, you are my father-in-law.
Of course I am, but... Now, look, Alec... You've got to stop being so mysterious. You know about my heart, what any sudden shock will do.
I don't think you need worry about that anymore, Mr. Clay. And as far as the mystery is concerned, this initial period of adjustment is always a little difficult.
Difficult? Do you realize what it's like, lying here helpless, completely isolated, as if I were all alone in the world? Or isn't there someone I can talk to? Some of the other patients?
Not just yet. When the time comes, you'll meet them.
But... Look, Doctor, I can't stand much more of this. I can't. If I don't find someone who really cares about me, who'll treat me like a normal human being...
Easy, Mr.
I won't take it easy. I won't stay here another minute. I'm leaving right now.
Sorry, but I don't think we can permit...
No, well, we'll see about that.
You're getting yourself all upset for no reason, Mr. Clay. Making it very difficult for the rest of us. Martin, yes. You'd better let me have some of that bottle there. About 10 cc's.
The red medicine?
Yes.
I don't want any medicine. I won't take it.
Now, please, Mr. Clay.
I won't, I tell you. No, I don't want the... it's awful. Salty. It tastes like...
Yes. But I think you'll find that it will make things much easier for you. Very much easier.
You're doping me up. That's what you're doing. Putting me to sleep. You think that when I wake up, I'll forget about everything.
Yes, Mr. Clay. You'll forget about everything.
Somewhere deep down under the earth. It was a passageway, stone flagged and with stone walls, and I was walking slowly down it in my bare feet. I could feel the chill of the cold stones through the thick layer of dust. The passageway stretched ahead of me endlessly, and suddenly I noticed that there were doors set into the walls on either side. Closed doors. And on each door there was a name. Abel. Abercrombie. Abington. Where was I? What was this place? What was behind those awful, ominously closed doors? Something seemed to be drawing me on down the terrible passageway. Addison, Agar, Alan. I could feel the cold creeping up my legs, higher and higher, my heart pounding faster and faster. And suddenly I knew.
knew where I was and where I was going. Knew what was waiting for me there ahead of me down the passage. Exerting all my will, I turned, trying to go back. With a roar in my ears, I was falling through the darkness. When I opened my eyes, I was in that cold, white room again, clutching the blankets with trembling hands.
How do you feel now, Mr. Clay?
You cried out, sir, as if... Oh, a dream. The most awful, horrible nightmare I ever had.
A dream? The doctor will be very interested. Would you care to tell me all about it?
Oh, I don't even want to think about it.
It was about your former life?
Former life?
Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. I meant... Here, where are you going?
Get my clothes to get out of here. I won't stay
but
here
another
minute.
You can't go. You can't, Martin. Help me.
Please, Mr. Clay, don't you realize that if I do stay here, if I dream that dream again... Listen. I was in a passageway. An endless, eternal passageway like a corridor of doom. It stretched on and on to infinity with doors, closed doors on either side. And on each one of the doors, in alphabetical order, there was a name. The name of all those who had died since the beginning of time. I was walking down that corridor on my bare feet and... Why? Why are you looking at me that way?
You mustn't talk about that. You mustn't, do you hear?
But you asked me.
You didn't dream that dream. You couldn't have. And you've got to get it out of your mind. We'll help you. We'll give you a massage. That should make you relax. The alcohol, Martin, right over there.
Yeah, a massage. You think that'll help?
If it doesn't, we'll call Dr. Stone. Try something else. Martin.
I see. Now what? What are you staring at?
Your feet.
On the soles. Dust. Thick, gray dust. Dust. Like the dust in the passage. The corridor of doom. And that means... It wasn't a dream. It means... I was really there. Down at my feet. No, it had not been a dream. But there, on my feet, was the thick, heavy dust from the corridor of doom. I had been there, walking down its awful silence, not in my mind, but in the flesh. My heart clenched like an icy fist, and I threw the blankets aside, started to get up.
Mr. Clay, what are you doing? Where are you going?
Let me go.
But you can't get up. You can't leave.
Oh, let me go.
Martin, quick, help me.
Please, Mr. Clay. For heaven's sake, let me go. Don't you realize what this means? If it wasn't a dream, and if I stay here, go down to that horrible place
We've
again...
We've got to make him quiet down. Some more of that medicine, Martin. Another 10 cc.
Right. Oh, no more of that. It's here, Mr. Clay.
You must take it. You must. It'll make you sleep. Sleep so soundly that you won't be able to go down there again.
No, what? All right. Give it to me.
Here. You stay here, Martin. I'll go get Dr. Stone and tell him.
Better, Mr. Clay? I don't know. Color. Dark red. Taste. It's like...
Yes, I know. And it makes me sleepy.
My eyes get heavy and... Have you been here for a long time, Martin?
No, not long.
What is it like outside of this room?
It's strange. Like no place else.
And the other patients, what are they like?
They're strange, too.
Listen, Martin. I'm a rich man. You're the only friend I've got here. You've got to help me.
Whether you're rich or poor doesn't matter. As to helping you, that's what I'm here for.
You've got to stay here. Watch. Every minute. My heart.
I don't think it'll stand for much.
My first sensation was one of cold, numbing cold, creeping up my limbs. I reached for the blankets, couldn't find them. Then I opened my eyes, and I was there again, back there in that awful endless passage, that corridor of doom. The same stone wall, stone floor, covered with a thick layer of dust. The same doors with a name on each one, on both sides of me. But now... now I was up to the bees. That one there, Barber, next to it, Babbitt, and then Backer. I tried to cry out, but I couldn't utter a sound. I tried to stop, check myself. My muscles didn't respond. Slowly, heavily, I continued walking on down that endless passage. Past Badger, Baffin, Bagley, past the bees and towards the sea. Towards a door with my name on it. My heart pulsed, pounding with terror. My breath rasped in my throat. Convulsively, I clutched at the wall and forced myself completely around. Then, as if I were fighting against a roaring gale, I drove myself back. One step I took, two, three. Then I stumbled. I was falling again. Falling through darkness. Complete. Absolute. Unending. Even before I opened my eyes, I knew where I was. Back in my room, the sheets crumpled in my sweating hands. I lay there for a moment. I knew that this was my last chance. Slipped out of bed, dipped over to the door of the room, opened it a crack, and peered out to hospital corridor. And sitting at a desk halfway down it, the nurse. Could I slip past her? Then on a table next to the door, I saw the telephone. A telephone! Now I could get help. Would someone who would save me take me out of this place? Picking it up quietly, I dialed my daughter's number, Alec Bartlett's wife.
Hello?
Jane? Oh, thank heaven.
Hello?
Jane, it's your father. Listen, you've got to help me. You've got to come and get me. I'm at the hospital. Alec
knows
where.
Hello, is anyone there?
Yes, can't you hear me? Didn't you hear what I said? It's your father and... Jane! Hung up. I heard her, but she couldn't hear me. Something wrong with the phone, her phone. I've got to get hold of somebody. Somebody, but who? Dr. Rogers? Oh, might be out. If they come in while I'm phoning... Oh, I know, of course. Hello, police. This is John Clay of Riverside Road. I'm at the hospital. I don't know where.
Hello?
Can't you hear me, officer? For heaven's sake, listen. It's a matter of life and death. John Clay at a hospital. My son-in-law, Alec Bartlett, can tell you where.
Hello?
Officer, officer, listen. Don't hang up. Don't.
I'm nuts.
Officer, officer, hello.
Anything the matter, Mr. Clay?
Dr. Stone, your telephone, Liz. There's something wrong with it.
No, Mr. Clay. There's nothing wrong. Not with the telephone.
But I tried to make two calls. Two different numbers and...
I know. You should have known. Nurse, all of them.
Should have known what? Why couldn't they hear me when I could hear them? Why?
Yes, Dr. Stone.
Will you put Mr. Clay back into bed?
No.
I'm awfully sorry, sir. I only went out for a minute. Come on, Mr. Clay.
No,
please.
Leave me alone. Please,
Mr.
let go. No.
No, you're struggling. You know that, don't you?
Yes. I know. Doctor, I won't have to go back down there again, will I? Down to the corridor?
That's not up to me. All right, nurse. I think we're ready for another dose. The final one.
Yes, doctor.
No, not. No, not that red medicine. Not again.
I'm sorry, but you've had a lot of time. All the time we can give you.
All right, Mr. Clay.
No, I won't take it. You know what it means, doctor. I go back down there again to the corridor. It'll be to the letter C. To the place where my name is.
If he won't take it by himself, perhaps you'd better help her, Martin.
Yes, sir.
No, yeah. No, I won't, doctor. I knew where I was before I opened my eyes. I could feel the dust under my bare feet, and through the dust, the biting chill of the cold stones. I was there, back in the corridor, walking down its silent length past the blank, closed doors. For the names on the doors, now they were all C's. Cabot, Cadden, Cahoon. On I walked, the beating of my heart, the pounding of my pulse loud in my ears. On down the passage, no longer even trying to fight against what I knew was inevitable. On past Camelon, Chelsea, Chiswick, and then, suddenly, terribly, one door. A door with my name on it, gaping, waiting for me. I tried to stop to turn, but my legs carried me forward. I was but two doors away. I could see into it now, see that it contained nothing. Absolutely nothing, not even a coffin. Just stone walls and a flat stone slab. I was turning to step over the threshold. I made a last convulsive effort.
All right, Martin. Pick him up.
Yes, sir.
Is it all over? Hello, Bartlett. In at the death, eh? I'll see if there's any pulse, of course, but I should think it is all over.
It is, Stone, but not the way you think.
But Clay,
he's not dead.
No thanks to you. All right, get him up, both of you. Here, Mr. Clay, let me help you.
All right, Martin. I'll be fine from now on.
But how?
Don't look so surprised, Alec. Mr. Martin is a detective. I hired him some time ago. You see, I had a feeling that something was wrong when that railing broke accidentally, and I took that bad fall. So I decided I should investigate.
You can't prove it. You can't prove anything.
The first results of Martin's investigation showed me what bad financial shape you were in. And it was then that I realized that you had actually been trying to murder me to get hold of my money. So I faked that story of having a very bad heart.
You mean it?
I thought it would give you the idea of trying something more subtle and less dangerous. And it certainly did.
But you still can't prove anything, not a thing.
No, don't you worry about that. Don't forget. Come back here, Bartlett.
You'll never have a chance to prove it.
Come back, Bartlett.
Well, you shot him, killed him.
Well, I couldn't have. I fired up in the air to get him to stop.
Come on.
I don't understand. Yeah, not a mark on him. But he is dead.
He was the one who had the bad heart. That's what gave me the idea of pretend. Good heavens, look.
At what?
This hallway was supposed to be the corridor of doom. When I reached the door with my name on it, I was supposed to die. Look. Look at the name on that door there. The one right next to him.
Bartlett. His name. So what?
Nothing, Martin. Nothing at all.
Where do you think old Dr. Stone got the idea for that little alphabetical graveyard? That's right, for me. Huh? You don't believe me? Then come on home with me tonight and I'll show you the one in the cellar of my house. What's more, I'll show you a door and a neat stone slab with your name on it. And now a word of advice. If you should wake up tonight with a sudden chill, find yourself walking barefoot down a dusty stone corridor with doors on both sides of it, don't get excited. Just insist on a doom with a view. Good night. Pleasant dreams.
CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Strange Adventure. The night was cold and dark. The stars flickered in the winter sky like millions of shivering lights. Ralph Hagstrom felt utterly alone as he skimmed across the lake, his blades cutting a knife-like trail in the ice. He would be glad to reach the little village to attend the wedding of Paul Boudreau and Marie Levesque. Marie. He thought of her dancing eyes and bewitching smile. He had loved Marie, loved her madly. Now she was to become the bride of his best friend. He was to be the best man. He glanced at the luminous dial on his watch. 10:00. It came to him like a shock that he was not alone. His eyelashes were frosted and his eyes blurred with the cold. A trick of nature, he thought. He rubbed his eyes and looked again. Yes, there it was, far in front of him, the figure of a skater in long white garments that fluttered ghost-like in the clear night. The phantom skater glided over the ice with a speed and grace that matched his very own, ever staying the same distance ahead. He called aloud, but there was no answer. He saw the figure ahead lift an arm, beckoning him to follow. He wondered who this stranger must be and determined to find out. He followed, thinking to catch his wraith-like companion. But however fast he might go, the white skater went faster. His strange companion seemed to draw him irresistibly, and so he followed through the night. When dawn came, she was gone, and the young man found himself at his destination. He removed his skates and followed the path that ran along the shore of the lake. As the sun rose above the wooded hills, he chanced to gaze lakeward. He was awe-stricken at the sight that met his eyes. There was a great wind drift in the ice. Had he swept along his intended path, watching the stars to guide him, he would have skated into this danger area. His speed and weight would have sent him crashing through the broken ice to a chilling death below. He remembered the white skater. The phantom figure had been his guardian angel. Ralph hurried to the home of his friend. Paul Boudreau opened the door. Ralph sensed there was something wrong.
What's the matter, Paul? This is your wedding day.
No wedding.
What do you mean?
Marie died last night.
Ralph was stunned. Some accident or some strange malady must have struck her down. He inquired of his friend.
Paul was sad as he spoke. Yesterday afternoon, Marie went skating on the ice. She came home chilled and wandering in her mind. She fell ill and became delirious. She talked of you, Ralph.
Of me? I don't understand.
Neither did we.
She said you were on the ice, that you were on your way here. She said you didn't know of the ice breaking up and begged me to meet you and warn you of the danger. She told me she loved you and you must be saved. She died as the clock was striking 10.
Ralph pondered, remembering. It was at 10:00 when he had noted the time and when he had first seen his phantom guide. This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye for my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of Strange Adventure.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. Thank you. This is Ellery Queen with the case I call The Psychological Error. Police were befuddled by the story of a man named Ames who said he had shot his neighbor in a fit of complete terror and fear. Ames said his neighbor had approached him while he, Ames, was out shooting. The neighbor had repeatedly threatened me, Ames said, and in panic, my reflexes told me to fire. I told him I didn't know where he was getting his reflexes tested, but they weren't working. In a moment, the rest of the story.
Two finger frosting from Duncan Hines tastes even better on your cake. Two finger frosting from Duncan Hines tastes even better on your cake.
In the case of the psychological error, a shooting by reflex as a result of fear is not reasonable. Reflexes are the result of conditioning. The murderer tried to fool me with psychology, but I psyched him instead. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
I got a little bit of a conundrum here. Next show is an episode of X-1 for October the 10th of 1957 called Death Wish. It's based on a short story by Ned Lang, who is far better known as Robert Sheckley, who published the story in Galaxy for June of 1956. You see, Robert Sheckley was so prolific during this period that he had several pseudonyms. That's not the conundrum. The conundrum is that I also have the original text as read by Greg Marguerite for the LibriVox project. And they run about the same time, so I could easily use either of them in here. What I've decided to do, for at least now, is to go ahead and play the X-1 adaptation of Death Wish. But what I'll do is I will put on the website, in the show notes, a link to Greg Marguerite's reading of the actual short story. I also expect that there will be a link to a PDF and ebook copy of the short story. This will all be found by going to www.nighttransmissions.com. Looking over to the left when you land on the front page, you'll see what is intended to look like a book spine. I'll leave it to you whether or not it does. And on the book spine, there are two ways to get to the show notes for this particular show. Show 69. If you're here in a timely manner, you just click on the latest show and show 69 will pop up. However, if you're a little bit tardy, what you'll need to do is click on the shows instead of the latest show. And it's right above it, no real problem. And there you'll be given a menu of every show I've ever done. Here again, you look for show number 69. You click on that, and it'll bring up the show notes for show 69. And then if you look down the page, you'll see a section where it says Extras. Look in there. You'll find a link to Greg Marguerite's reading of Death Wish. And you can listen to the LibriVox recording or download it. You'll also find a link to that PDF or ebook file I mentioned. Now then, next week, I'm going to run the show again. But next week, I'm going to reverse this. I'm going to play Greg Marguerite's reading of the short story and post in the extras section the X-1 version. Anyway, I thought I'd just mention this. I don't know how many people actually go to the website. I'm rather slipshod about this whole thing. I don't know how many people listen. I don't know how many people go to the website. I don't know nothing much. I followed the example of dear Sergeant Schultz, who knew nothing, and so I know nothing.
countdown for blast-off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Tonight, Death Wish by Ned Lang.
Fuel consumption normal.
We'll reach Point Able in 10 seconds from now. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Cut.
Well, gentlemen, we're on our way to Mars. Now, Mr. Ratchick, give me a 30-second warning before we reach Point Baker.
Very well, Captain. Now, Mr. Watkins, what's the condition of your engines?
Don't you worry about my engines. The Deidre may be a cantankerous old crate, but she's good for another 5 or 10 round trips to Mars. You can lay to that.
Look at him, Captain. If anybody criticizes his engines, you can actually see that walrus mustache of his bristle.
Listen, Ratchick, I've had about enough of these personal remarks of yours. Stick to your navigation and let me alone.
Now, Watkins, let's not get into another of those arguments. Now, that's an order.
Aye, sir.
You had a reason for asking about your engines. I've made enough trips to Mars to know the way a ship should sound. There's something about this one. I don't know quite what.
There's nothing wrong with this ship, Captain Summers. I'll tell you something, though, every engineer worth his salt knows. There are just two kinds of equipment. The kind that fails bit by bit, and the kind that goes all at once. When something happens to the Deidre, you'll know it right away. You won't have to ask.
Well, maybe so. I wonder if our cargo didn't shift on the takeoff. Mr. Ratchick, yes, would you be kind enough to check on it?
You bet, Captain, right away.
You worried about that new Ferenson computer we're carrying, Captain?
Oh, not worried exactly, but it's a responsibility. That thing is by far the largest, heaviest, most delicate piece of machinery ever transported in space.
It's an evil thing, with its blinking eyes and scheming brain. I'll be glad to get to Marsport and get it off the ship.
So will I, Watkins, but not quite for the same reason. I don't quite share your feelings about the personality of machines.
That's because you don't know anything about them, Captain. I do. And I don't like that computer thing back there in the hold.
All in order in the hold, boss. Cargo hasn't shifted.
All right, Mr. Ratchick. Maybe I'm borrowing trouble,
30 seconds to Point Baker, sir.
Very well. Strap yourselves on the acceleration couches again. You sure you don't read anything, Mr. Watkins?
Not a thing, sir. I'll vouch for every bit of equipment on the Deidre.
15 seconds to Point Baker.
Prepare for new acceleration.
Engines ready for firing, sir.
10, 9, 8.
We fire for 7, exactly 5 seconds, 6, on reaching Point Baker 5, for maximum acceleration.
4, 3, 2, 1, fire!
It's fine. It didn't cut off.
We're over-firing. My fuel!
The course! We'll be off course!
The switch doesn't respond.
Emergency cutoff. Hit the emergency.
I can't move my arms. Acceleration.
Stop it. Stop the rockets.
My arms are so heavy. If I could just reach the cutoff switch. There.
What happened?
We're on emergency lights. We blew the generator. Of all the lousy things to happen.
Well, what was it?
Main firing circuit. It fused on us. Metal fatigue, I'd say. Must have been flawed for years.
When was it last checked out?
Well, it's a sealed unit, Captain. It's supposed to outlast the ship. Absolutely foolproof.
Unless it's flawed.
Now, don't go blaming it on me. Those circuits are supposed to be X-rayed, heat-treated, fluoroscoped. You just can't trust machinery.
How are we on fuel?
Not enough to push a kiddie car down Main Street. If I could just get my hands on those factory inspectors...
Mr. Ratchick, how does this affect our course?
I'm computing it now.
Well, hurry it up.
I'm working as fast as I can.
Mr. Watkins, can we fire those rockets on manual?
Sure we can. But we only have enough fuel for about a 3-second burst. It'll mean a crash landing.
We'll worry about that when we come to it. Well, Mr. Ratchick,
This kills us, Captain. We're going to cross the orbit of Mars before Mars gets there.
How long?
Too long. Captain, we're flying out of the solar system at just under the speed of light.
Look at him. Look at how he sits there staring at nothing. Here we are kiting off into space, and what do? We got a little fuel left. We can turn the ship, can't we? Look, you are a navigator, aren't you?
I am, Mr. Watkins. And for your information, if I plotted my courses the way you maintain your engines, we'd be plowing into the middle of Australia right now.
Why, you little company toady. At least I got my job honestly. Not by marrying the owner's daughter.
Why, you dirty old man.
Stop it, both of you. No more of this now. I give the orders here.
All right, then give some. Tell him to plot a return curve. This is life and death.
All the more reason for keeping our heads. Mr. Atchett, can you plot such a course?
The first thing I tried. On the fuel we got left, there isn't a chance. Best I could do would be a degree or two. That won't help.
What do you mean it won't? We'll turn back into the solar system.
Sure, but the best curve we can make will take us a few thousand years to complete.
What about a landfall on some other planet? Neptune, Uranus?
Impossible. In the first place, the right planet would have to be in the right place at the right time. And if it were, we'd need fuel, a lot of fuel, to get into a braking orbit. And if we could, who'd come and get us? No ship has gone past Mars yet.
Yeah, but maybe there'd be a chance, just a slim chance.
Maybe, but we can't swing it. Gentlemen, I'm afraid we'll have to kiss the solar system goodbye.
It just doesn't seem possible.
Who would believe we're traveling at almost the speed of light? Look out the viewing port. You'd swear we were standing still in space.
Yeah, that's because there's no reference point, as you know. I assure you, we're traveling faster than any men have ever traveled.
What should we do, Captain?
I don't know, Watkins. I just don't know.
Our noble captain can't face the situation.
Of course I can face it. I can follow any course you plot. That's my only real responsibility.
Now let's get a grip on ourselves. Mr. Radjic, suppose you raise Mars on the radio.
Aye, aye, sir. Deidre to Marsport. Deidre to Marsport. Urgent. Repeat, urgent. Come in, Marsport.
Marsport to Deidre. Greet you. Over.
Emergency, Marsport. Firing mechanism jammed. Fuel almost totally expended. Acceleration 15 seconds past safe maximum. Heading out of solar system. Request help. Over.
Can you turn the ship, Deidre? Can you put it into any kind of an orbit? Over.
No fuel, Marsport. We can only turn a degree or two. Over.
Put your captain on, Deidre. Over.
Captain Summers, Marsport. Over. Good Lord, man, that's what we're asking you.
What do you propose to do?
What are they saying?
I don't know. I couldn't catch it. Mr. Radjic, can't you get better reception?
We're rapidly running out of range, Captain. I'll give it all the gain I can get.
To Deidre. Marsport to Deidre. Can you read me?
There they are.
Shut up. Deidre, what can you do for us? Over.
Sort of orbit.
We can't. I told you that.
Under the circumstances, Captain, you have the right to try anything at all. Anything, Captain.
Oh, that's nice of them.
What do they expect us to do, complain to the company?
Listen, Marsport. Marsport, do you still read me? Over.
Read you faintly. Go on, but hurry.
I can think of just one thing. We could bail out in space suits as near Mars as possible. The Diana is laying over there, isn't she? You could have her pick us up. Over.
Sorry, Captain. You're confused. If you left your ship, your momentum would not be affected. You and your crew would continue through space at the same rate as the ship. Over.
Of course, I wasn't thinking. I have it. Send the Diana out to intersect our course. Maybe we can find some way to transfer. My navigator will help you plot the intersection. Over.
They're gone again.
Hello, Marsport. Hello, Marsport. Come in, Marsport.
I can't bring them in again.
To do it that way. Sorry. Over.
You mean you can't do it? Why not? It is our only chance. Over.
Diana's laid up, having her engines overhauled.
How long before she can be spaceborne?
Too long. 3 weeks. Sorry, Captain. I wish we could think of something. But the only thing we can suggest...
What? I didn't get it. Reception's gone again, Captain. We're getting out of range. I don't know whether I can raise him again or not.
Well, try. Come on, maybe that suggestion...
What can they suggest that we don't already know?
Even the static's getting weaker now.
If we only knew what they were going to say.
What's the difference? They didn't really think it would work anyhow.
Wait a minute. Wait. Maybe something come... Hold it.
Suggest. Can you hear? Suggest, most unlikely, but try calculator. Try calculator.
They're gone. For good this time.
I heard what he said. The calculator.
Does he mean the Farrenson computer in our hold?
Yes. Yes, I see what he meant. The Farrenson's a very advanced job. No one knows the limits of its potential. He suggests we present our problem to it.
Ah, that's ridiculous. The problem has no solution.
It doesn't seem to, but the big computers have solved other problems that seem to have no solution. Now, we can't lose anything by trying.
Yeah, not as long as we don't pin any hopes on
it. That's right. We don't dare hope. Mr. Watkins, I believe this is your department.
What's the use? You say don't hope, but both of you are hoping anyhow. You think the big electronic god is going to save your lives? Well, it's not.
Well, we have to try, man.
Who says we do? I wouldn't give it the satisfaction of turning us down.
Are you implying that machines think?
You bet I am, because they do. No, I'm not out of my head. Any engineer will tell you that a complex machine has a personality all its own. Do you know what that personality is like? It's cold, withdrawn, uncaring, unfeeling. A machine's only purpose is to frustrate desire and produce two problems for every one it solves. And do you know why a machine feels this way?
You're hysterical.
Oh, no, I'm not. A machine feels this way because it knows it's an unnatural creation in nature's domain. It wants to reach entropy and cease. It's a death wish. A mechanical death wish.
Gibberish. Watkins, are you going to hook up that computer?
Oh, sure, I'm human. I keep trying. I just wanted you to understand that there's no hope. I'll get it warmed up.
We better watch him.
He'll be all right.
Maybe. He's blaming the situation on a machine personality now, trying to absolve himself of guilt. It's his fault we're in this spot. An engineer is responsible for all equipment.
What's the good of blaming anybody?
None, I guess. Personally, I don't much care. This is as good a way to die as any. Better than most.
Don't talk like that.
Why not? Death in space is an appealing idea in certain ways. Imagine, an entire spaceship for a tomb. And you have a certain choice in how you die. Thirst, hunger, heat, cold...
Shut up! Now that's an order.
This is your first real emergency, Captain. And you're responding like a stunned ox. Wake up! You can't live with joy. At least try to extract a little pleasure out of your diet.
Shut your mouth.
Well, gents, your little tin god's ready and waiting. Anybody care to make a burnt offering in front of it?
Have you given it the problem?
Most of it. You two have to punch up your own details. Position, elapsed time from maximum acceleration, water, oxygen, food.
All right. Come on, Ratchik.
Did you tell it we want to return to Earth alive?
Oh, yes. Yes, it loves that part. It'll get such pleasure out of rejecting the problem as unsolved. Oh, no. It won't say that. It'll say insufficient data.
And I'll punch up the rest of the information.
Insufficient data. You see the point? It hints a solution is possible, but just out of reach. A subtle torture. It can keep us hoping.
There. That's the complete picture. Now let's see what happens when I press this.
Now just keep your eye on that red light up there. If it goes on, it means a problem is rejected. Watch it now.
And if it solves it?
That's a little bell, sort of like a typewriter bell. But you won't hear it, don't worry.
Don't say that.
What's the matter, Rajik? Superstitious?
Oh, shut up.
You two have to keep up that everlasting wrangling.
Well, not for long, Captain. We haven't much longer to live, Captain. Maybe that's good.
What's that?
A solution. It's found a solution.
That must be a mistake. There is no solution.
It's fooling us, leading us on.
Now who's superstitious?
Here. Here's the tape. The solution's on this.
Well, what's it say? Come on, come on, read it, read it.
No, not me. You read it, Captain. I won't play its fiendish game.
Oh, I see. That's fine. That's just fine.
What does it say, for the love of heaven?
You figured a few thousand years to return to the solar system, Ratchik? Well, the computer agrees. 2,300 years, to be precise. Therefore, it has given us the formula for a longevity serum.
2,300 years? What are we supposed to do, hibernate?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, the serum does away quite neatly with the need for sleep. But 2,300 years, gentlemen. We three sit here in this little ship and look at each other. 2,300 years of that!
Yeah. Yeah, that's just the sort of thing a machine would do.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine. X-1 has brought you Death Wish, a story written by Ned Lang and adapted for radio by William Welch. Featured in our cast were Ralph Camargo as Watkins, Maurice Tarplin as Captain Summers, Walter Black as Ratchek, and Joseph Bell as the radioman. This is Fred Collins speaking. X-1 was directed by George Hootsas and is an NBC Radio Network production.
The Happy Family by Hans Christian Andersen. Recorded by Gesine. This is a LibriVox recording. Really, the largest green leaf in this country is a dock leaf. If one holds it before one, it is like a whole apron, and if one holds it over one's head in rainy weather, it is almost as good as an umbrella, for it is so immensely large. The burdock never grows alone, but where there grows one, there always grow several. It is a great delight, and all this delightfulness is snail's food. The great white snails, which persons of quality in former times made fricassees of, ate and said, "Hum, hum, how delicious!" for they thought it tasted so delicate, lived on dock leaves, and therefore burdock seeds were sown. Now there was an old manor house, where they no longer ate snails. They were quite extinct. But the burdocks were not extinct. They grew and grew all over the walks and all the beds. They could not get the mastery over them. It was a whole forest of burdocks. Here and there stood an apple and a plum tree, or else one never would have thought that it was a garden. All was burdocks, and there lived the two last venerable old snails. They themselves knew not how old they were, but they could remember very well that there had been many more, that they were of a family from foreign lands, and that for them and theirs the whole forest was planted. They had never been outside it, but they knew that there was still something more in the world, which was called the manor house, and that they were boiled, and then they became black, and were then placed on a silver dish. But what happened further they knew not, or, in fact, what it was to be boiled, and to lie on a silver dish. They could not possibly imagine. But it was said to be delightful, and particularly genteel. Neither the chafers, the toads, nor the earthworms, whom they asked about it, could give them any information. None of them had been boiled or laid on a silver dish. The old white snails were the first persons of distinction in the world that they knew. The forest was planted for their sake, and the manor house was there that they might be boiled and laid on a silver dish. Now they lived a very lonely and happy life, and as they had no children themselves, they had adopted a little common snail, which they brought up as their own. But the little one would not grow, for he was of a common family. But the old ones, especially Dame Mother Snail, thought they could observe how he increased in size, and she begged Father, if he could not see it, that he would at least feel the little snail's shell. And then he felt it, and found the good dame was right. One day, there was a heavy storm of rain. "Hear how it beats like a drum on the dock leaves," said Father Snail. "There are also raindrops," said Mother Snail, "and now the rain pours right down the stalk. You will see that it will be wet here. I am very happy to think that we have our good house, and the little one has his also. There is more done for us than for all the other creatures, sure enough. But can you not see that we are folks of quality in the world? We are provided with a house from our birth, and the burdock forest is planted for our sakes. I should like to know how far it extends, and what there is outside." "There is nothing at all," said Father Snail. "No place can be better than ours, and I have nothing to wish for." "Yes," said the dame, "I would willingly go to the manor house, be boiled and laid on a silver dish. All our forefathers have been treated so. There is something extraordinary in it, you may be sure." "The manor house has most likely fallen to ruin," said Father Snail. "All the burdocks have grown up over it, so that they cannot come out. There need not, however, be any haste about that. But you are always in such a tremendous hurry, and the little one is beginning to be the same. Has he not been creeping up that stalk these 3 days? It gives me a headache when I look up to him." "You must not scold him," said Mother Snail. "He creeps so carefully, he will afford us much pleasure, and we have nothing but him to live for. But have you not thought of it? Where shall we get a wife for him? Do you not think that there are some of our species in the great distance in the interior of the burdock forest?" "Black snails, I dare say, there are enough of," said the old one. "Black snails without a house. But they are so common and so conceited. But we might have the ants commissioned to look out for us. They run to and fro as if they had something to do, and they certainly know of a wife for our little snail." "I know one, sure enough, the most charming one," said one of the ants. "But I am afraid we shall hardly succeed, for she is a queen." "That is nothing," said the old folks. "Has she a house?" "She has a palace," said the ant. "The finest ant's palace, with 700 passages." "I thank you," said Mother Snail. "Our son shall not go into an anthill. If you know nothing better than that, we shall give the commission to the white gnats. They fly far and wide, in rain and sunshine. They know the whole forest here, both within and without." "We have a wife for him," said the gnats. "At 100 human paces from here, there sits a little snail in her house, on a gooseberry bush. She is quite lonely, and old enough to be married. It is only 100 human paces." "Well, then, let her come to him," said the old ones. "He has a whole forest of burdocks. She has only a bush." And so they went and fetched little Miss Snail. It was a whole week before she arrived, but therein was just the very best of it, for one could thus see that she was of the same species. And then the marriage was celebrated. 6 earthworms shone as well as they could. In other respects, the whole went off very quietly, for the old folks could not bear noise and merriment. But old Dame Snail made a brilliant speech. Father Snail could not speak. He was too much affected. And so they gave them, as a dowry and inheritance, the whole forest of burdocks, and said, what they had always said, that it was the best in the world, and if they lived honestly and decently, and increased and multiplied, they and their children would once in the course of time come to the manor house, be boiled black, and laid on silver dishes. After this speech was made, the old ones crept into their shells, and never more came out. They slept. The young couple governed in the forest, and had a numerous progeny. But they were never boiled, and never came on the silver dishes. So from this they concluded that the manor house had fallen to ruins, and that all the men in the world were extinct. And as no one contradicted them, so of course it was so. and the rain beat on the dock leaves to make drum music for their sake, and the sun shone in order to give the burdock forest a colour for their sakes. And they were very happy, and the whole family was happy, for they indeed were so. End of The Happy Family. Read by Gesine in Valletta, May 2006.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the next 7 years of bigger and bigger enrollments, America's grade schools will need nearly 250,000 extra teachers besides those to fill normal vacancies. This great need, plus the growing public interest in education and improvements in schools, make elementary school teaching a more rewarding career than ever, a career that high school and college students should certainly consider. Education holds America's future, perhaps your future.
Coming up next is an episode from Suspicion, a program that aired via syndication in 1935. I've said it before, but I think I'll say it again. I won't take too long. The coolest thing about doing what I do here is coming across programs that are this old, programs from near the beginning of commercial radio, and finding them still around and playing them. This really is as close to a time machine as you can get. Oh, one more thing about Suspicion. It was originally conceived and executed as a serial, where any given part would lead quite naturally into the subsequent part of the serial. What they did is they would present a mystery, not really give you the resolution until the next time. Well, that doesn't work here, does it? So what I've done, in one of the few instances where I will attempt to edit the body of a program itself, is to go ahead, find the next show, clip out the relevant part, the explanation, the whodundunit, and try to edit it seamlessly. And something else I'll leave to your judgment, whether it's seamless or not, into the existing program. That way you won't have to wait. And that's the only thing that makes any sense to me. Anyway, this will play itself out for about 15 minutes, and then I'm going to turn to music for the remainder of our time here together. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I've enjoyed bringing it to you. You can always write me at Gmail. The address there is nighttransmissions@gmail.com. Night Transmissions is one word. No funny stuff. No space between the night and the transmissions. No dash. No dot. Nothing. Just one word. nighttransmissions@gmail.com. Be seeing ya.
To radio's newest, most interesting and thrilling program, Suspicion. And now, Suspicion. Somewhere in the drama about to be presented is a seemingly unimportant fact, a hidden clue that first casts suspicion on the ultimate culprit. Listen regularly to this thrilling series. Test your powers of observation and deduction, and find the hidden clue. It may be a single line, a sound, perhaps a complete scene. All names and characters depicted in this story are fictitious. Any resemblance to persons living or dead is entirely coincidental. Now we present Ransom. Shortly after 10 o'clock on the night of May 10th, when Mrs. Charles Edwards, wife of a wealthy manufacturer in a large city on the West Coast, enters the room of her two-year-old son.
Quiet, Charles. Turn on the side light, please. You must be... Charles! Charles! My baby! He's gone, Charles! He's gone!
Hello. Lieutenant Mason speaking.
What's that?
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yes, I see. Have you touched anything, Mr. Edwards? No, no. Don't even go in the room. I'll arrange to have every incoming phone call traced. Yes, we'll leave at once. You'd better call the doctor for you.
That's everything that I know, Lieutenant. The bed was empty. Junior was gone.
I see. Now, Mr. Edwards, I want you to be absolutely frank with me.
Yes, sir.
Have you any idea who might have kidnapped your son?
No, sir, I haven't.
Have you had any business difficulties?
Well, yes, but I doubt if they would have stooped to such...
Just what was the trouble, Mr. Edwards?
Protective racket, I suppose you'd call it, Lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
Last week, a couple of men talked to me about a special insurance and a payoff on one of my plants.
I see.
When I said I wasn't interested, they threatened to make things tough for me.
Their names?
John Jones and Sam Smith. One was quite bald and rather tall. The other, a much shorter man, had flaming red hair.
I see.
But it isn't likely they'd turn to kidnapping in order to
you
force me.
You never tell what criminals will do, Mr. Edwards. Now, before we question the servants, I'm going to tell you just what we'll do. When the kidnappers contact you, follow their instructions to the letter. Cooperate with the newspapers, and they'll probably be our biggest help. Play ball with them.
No, play ball with
us. Good afternoon, Evening Journal.
Mabel, this is Jim Croft. Give me the chief.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, what do you want?
Hello, big shot. This is Jim. Say, has
How'd you break out?
I didn't.
Huh?
Listen, the five men in town I figured might be in the know aren't. I've checked on all of them, and they've had nothing to do with young Edwards. It's either an out-of-town mob or there's a different angle on it.
You've got to find out which, Jim.
Well, sure. Say, has a go-between been named yet?
Not that I know of. Edwards got a phone call a couple of hours ago saying one would be appointed before 6 p.m. He asked us to keep it quiet.
Okay. Now, if you want to reach me within the next half hour, call the North Sea Cafe. The one guy I figure might know something is Baldy Jones. And if he's cutting on the reward, maybe he'll talk. See you later.
Hello, Jim. How's Trick?
Hi, Baldy. Long time no see.
Grab a chair. You're working on this snatch case, huh?
That's right.
You're wasting your time with me, pal. I don't know nothing.
There's a reward offered
Get
for...
Get this straight. If I knowed who done it, I'd tip off the law, see? But I ain't heard a word about it. Neither has any of the boys in town.
Okay, Baldy.
The guys I work with don't have nothing to do with snatchers. It ain't in our line.
Sure. Say, have you seen any strangers around?
I hear there's a couple of guys in from the east trying to peddle protective insurance.
Yeah?
Yeah. And they're gonna leave pretty quick or walk into a pile of trouble. I don't like competition.
Yeah, where do they hang out?
Over at the New Moon. You know the joint on 4th Street.
Yeah, I've been there. Say, who's that guy?
Huh?
At the corner table there. He's taking off his hat. You know him?
No, I never seen him in here before.
Me neither. But he looks familiar.
Yeah, he does. Say, where are you going?
So long, Baldy. I'll see you later. Have you got a match, Mr.?
Hello. Insurance is a good investment, isn't it?
Yeah.
I honestly believe that insurance is... Who are you?
Keep your shirt on, brother.
Oh. Then you are... Well, I'm sorry. I made a frightful mistake.
You're Conrad Bliss, aren't you?
Yes, but
how... Have you been appointed go-between by the kidnappers?
Oh, yes, but I...
How did it happen? Oh, don't worry about me. I'm a reporter, and we're playing ball with the Edwards. Well?
I can't say anything.
How about seeing you later on, when everything's set?
Very well. I'll do that. If you'll promise not to print anything until Junior's returned.
Okay, that's a deal. My car's parked at the end of the alley. It's a white roadster. I'll wait for you. Everything okay, Mr. Bliss?
Yes, I think so. But you almost spoiled.
Well, get in the car and tell me about it.
Well, there really isn't anything to tell. This morning I received a note. telling me to be at the North Sea Cafe from 2:30 until, well, until I was spoken to.
Yes?
Well, a few moments after you left, a rather tall man came in and walked right over to my table. He asked for a match. I answered that insurance is a good investment.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that the baby was quite well and would be returned as soon as the ransom was paid.
How much?
$50,000.
Will you describe the man you spoke to?
Well, I don't believe it's wise.
When's the ransom to be paid?
Oh, please. I'd rather not say anything. Would you mind driving me to the bank now?
Okay.
If you'll tell me your name and which paper you're with, I'll give you the story as soon as possible. But I must insist that nothing be printed until after the baby is returned.
Hello, Claire?
Yes, what's up, Jimmy?
Plenty, but I can't talk now. Listen, I'm pulling from Boswell's restaurant on 8th Street. I want you to pick me up in 15 minutes.
Okay.
I'll meet you at the service entrance on Madison Street. Put Tubby Wells on the phone now. I have a hunch we'll scoop the town on this story, but it's going to take cooperation.
Gee, when you put it together that way, Jim, it does look like he's the kidnapper.
Right. Well, we'll stop here and wait a couple of minutes. You see, we've got to get him with the goods or he'll squirm out of it.
Yeah.
Right now, there's not a shred of proof against him. It's just suspicion.
And if we follow Conrad Blitz...
Well, maybe we shouldn't try it, Claire, but I think it's the right hunch to follow. And if Tubby Wells does his part...
Oh, don't worry. He will.
If he doesn't, I'll ring his... Say, that was Bliss who just stopped up ahead.
Uh-oh.
Gosh, I'd give my eye teeth to know where he's going.
Mr. Edwards is giving him a package.
A ransom money.
Hey, Jim, you better phone the police and tell them that we're out.
What are you doing? They'll tell us to beat it. If you want to pull out, Claire...
No, I'm sticking, Jim.
Good. Now, as soon as... Uh-oh. No time for that. Bliss is leaving. We'll give him a block, head start, and then follow. Just keep your fingers crossed that this hunch is right.
How much further do you think you'll go, Jim?
Your guess is as good as mine. We're 10 miles from the city.
Probably the baby's being kept in a summer cabin around here.
Yeah, there's no telling. We'll just have to trail along and find out. But it's a cinch he won't go much farther.
Turning off the highway now.
Yeah, and there's not a car within a mile of us. I think we'd better switch off our lights and take a chance.
Now, have you got a gun?
Didn't you bring one?
No, I thought that you...
It's too late now.
Hey,
Listen. As soon as we find where the baby's being held, you go to the nearest phone and call the state police.
Well, but maybe you'll need me.
Forget me. Call the police. Say, there's Bliss's car in front of the second house.
Oh.
No, don't stop now. Drive up the road away and let me out.
Right.
I'll stay outside until the police come. But for the love of Mike, tell him to hurry for once. Now, slow down. I'll get out here.
Okay, jump.
Right. Make it snappy, Claire. So long.
Yes, I met the kidnappers, Croft, and gave them the money. Yes. Well, they left just a few seconds ago. Well, the baby is drugged, but they say he'll wake up and...
Drop that phone, Blitz.
Jim Croft, how...
Oh, you paid the ransom money, huh? What's this package?
Put up your hand.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello, Bliss. Say, what's going on?
Hey, hello, Tubby. This isn't Bliss, it's Jim.
Huh? Well, what's the fuss about, Jim?
Hey, thanks for doubling for me on the phone, Tubby.
Okay, but what's the story? The chief's getting crazier than usual.
It's a swell story, Tubby, and worked just the way I figured. The kidnapper of Charles Edwards Jr. is Conrad Bliss, the so-called go-between. Give me a rewrite and make it fast.
2 hours later, when a special edition containing Conrad Bliss's confession was rolling off the press, Jim Croft outlined the case to Claire Mason and other members of the city room.
Well, Bliss was out for money, just as any criminal. And to divert any possible suspicion, he created the tall, bald-headed man and the other one. At first, I believed him.
And suspected Baldy Jones, huh? Well, what made you change your mind, Jim?
Well, Claire, there was something he did that simply didn't click.
It was... Ladies and gentlemen, did you discover the hidden clue that caused Jim Croft to suspect that Conrad Bliss was the kidnapper? Do you remember this? Jim Croft of the Evening Journal went to the North Sea Cafe at 2:30 in the afternoon. While there, he spoke to Conrad Bliss.
You're Conrad Bliss, aren't you?
Yes.
Have you been appointed go-between by the kidnappers?
Yes.
That scene, ladies and gentlemen, was the hidden clue. In Jim Croft's own words...
What real kidnapper would meet a go-between in a fairly crowded cafe at 2:30 in the afternoon? It didn't make sense. That's why I suspected Conrad Bliss.
Suspicion.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing to me when you don't believe a word I say? We can't go on together with suspicious minds. And I know stops by to say hello. Would I still see suspicion in your eyes? But here we go again, asking where I've been. You can see the tears I feel I'm crying. Never lie to you. Mm-hmm. We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing to me when you don't believe a word I say? We can't go on together with suspicious minds.
what she wants to do. She knows what she wants to do, and I know I'm faking it. I'm not really faking it. Such a dubious soul. In the fallen vines, picking up the punchlines. I've just been faking it, not really making it. No, no, no. Is there any danger? No, no, not really. Just lean on me. Take the time to treat your friend and name is honestly. I've just been faking it, not really making it. This feeling of faking it, I still haven't shaken it. Prior to this lifetime, sure he was a tailor. Look at me.
Good morning, Mr. Leach. Have you had a busy day?
I own the tailor's face and hands. I am the tailor's face and hands. I know I'm faking it, faking it. I'm not really faking it. Shaking it, shaking it. I know I'm faking it. I'm not really faking it.
Soldier, I don't.